Hello and welcome to Ward Daily's Water Cooler Podcast. I'm Megan McLaughlin, and I'm joined by the other two M's, Clarence Moy and Joey Moser, for a very special podcast. The six-part Lifetime docuseries Surviving R. Kelly took audiences by storm this past year, with its explosive revelations about the pop singer's relationships with young girls and women, which reignited the push to hold Kelly accountable for his actions. Kelly currently faces 40 counts of sex charges that carry a maximum combined sentence of 500 years in jail. For those who haven't seen the documentary, it details decades of sexual abuse against women and of color at the hands of Kelly and is one of the most important TV projects of the year. Ward Daily welcomes to the podcast a very special guest, Dream Hampton, executive producer and showrunner of Lifetime Surviving R. Kelly. Hi, Dream.
Hi.
Great to have you. It's such an honor. I watched all of this and have been hooked on it for like the whole year, so the whole story. But one of the words that comes immediately to mind about the documentary is thorough. And you cover so many angles when it comes to the people you interview, from music journalists to psychologists to, of course, the victims themselves. I was wondering, what kind of parameters did you set with the people you interviewed? Did you have any idea of how far you wanted to go?
You know, it varied with each kind of person, and you just kind of laid out a small map that I had on my wall, actually. We knew that we wanted to center, so in the center of that kind of drawing that I had in my office were his survivors, and then I had what I call the ecosystem, and then, yeah, I had these people that I wanted to provide context. So I absolutely knew, talking to the great music journalist Ann Powers, a longtime colleague who I've admired since I was in my early 20s, and is an expert on all things rock and roll, and actually wrote a book about rock and roll and sex and, you know, young women, actually. So I knew that I wanted her, when I had her in the studio, to kind of lay that out, like, that this is not a new phenomenon, and this is how these things kind of get overlooked. I can't remember the reporter's name. I talked to him. His name is Joe. He has an Italian last name, and he did some really heroic reporting around the Grammys and the New York Times about why there hasn't been a Me Too movement in the music industry. So with that article in mind, I wanted Anne to kind of unpack, you know, the history of, you know, us knowing that Elvis moved Priscilla in at 14 and that Jerry Lee Lewis was sleeping with his 13-year-old cousin and that we looked the other way, you know, when the Hilton on Sunset was like kind of, you know, I mean, Cameron Crowe, who I loved Almost Famous, but really had a euphemistic approach to that history of like teenagers and preteens being in these so-called relationships, but these illegal kind of affairs with rock stars. So that's a long history. I knew that I wanted her to lay something like that out. In terms of the therapists, I wanted those to be Black people. We have stigmas in our community. Other ethnic groups also have those stigmas, but in the Black community, you know, we are coming around to being able to publicly talk about mental health and to seek professional help around that, quite frankly. And I really wanted, so I have two Black women and one Black man therapist who obviously gave me all kinds of conditions on how they can't speak about someone that they've not diagnosed. So they would really limit it, how the kind of speculating they do on R. Kelly. They didn't want to risk their license, and it's just unethical for them to do so. And they, all three of them, you know, I got the spiel every time. I was used to it by the time I got the third one about what they would talk about in terms of me giving them a hypothetical and them, you know, not naming R. Kelly. So those kind of parameters existed. With the women, I mean, those were hours long interviews, and they went deep. And that was its own kind of marathon and emotional challenge.
So Dream, this is Clarence. So Surviving R. Kelly obviously premiered in January to great critical acclaim and became a conversation starter, or continued the conversation around him And then in February, Leaving Neverland also premiered, which was also acclaimed and also started a conversation or continued a conversation around Michael Jackson. I was curious if you saw any parallels between your excellent piece and Leaving Neverland in terms of the pattern of abuse between the rock star and the victim.
You know, to be honest, 2018 was an incredibly dark year for me, just working on Surviving R. Kelly. I worked on two other films, too. One was set in a prison, and one was about injustices in six different cities. So each of those topics were really dark.
Wow.
So I have not watched Leaving Neverland.
Wow.
So I can't speak to it. I know that they took a different approach. I saw maybe 20 minutes of it, and I saw that they didn't have people like therapists to provide context, that it was mostly the survivors and their parents.
Mm-hmm.
I saw maybe 20 minutes, and I saw that it was quite graphic, the description, which was a decision that I remember making decisions to scale some of the more graphic descriptions back in hours, and I wondered
right.
how gender factored into it. But no, I look at a parallel to R. Kelly to be closer to Jeffrey Epstein.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, before the feds started creating a sex, well, they probably had already been working on the case, but before it was announced that they were looking at a sex trafficking framework for R. Kelly, I had had one of the therapists, actually, who's on camera, said to me, I can't remember if we included it, but she said, you know, this operation sounds very much like a sex trafficking one. You know, the women that you're describing, how they recruited other women to come to his house, that very much sounds like a kind of informal sex trafficking ring. I very much, in terms of the women's vulnerability, to kind of, when you look at Harvey Weinstein, he had a lot of hubris. Like, the kind of women he was going after were, quite frankly, the women we consider to be the most beautiful women in the world, women that we imagine to have an enormous amount of power. I know that I think Gwyneth Paltrow and Angelina Jolie is having a certain amount of power just being A-listers in Hollywood. But Jeffrey Epstein and R. Kelly absolutely chose women who either were already damaged, who were vulnerable for different reasons, either economically or having, you know, kind of dysfunction in the family, who were plain in some ways, and who were too young to really know, you know, that they were being manipulated, quite frankly. So those are where I saw the parallels. There's a crisis around having to listen to Michael Jackson's music or not having to listen to it. I think I had an iron-on T-shirt with PYT on it, and now I wonder what Pretty Young Thing meant to R. Kelly. I mean, meant to Michael Jackson. I know what it meant to me. And this is something, you know, that is a constant question, the art versus the artist, you know? Picasso's work is absolutely about his abuse. Picasso literally rearranged the lives of the women and the psyches of the women that he abused, and that is evidenced in his paintings. And I would say the same about R. Kelly's work, where you can find all kind of evidence of his predation in his music. And I don't know, I've not been able to, like, I guess, gather the strength, quite frankly, to give that kind of analysis to Michael Jackson's music yet.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It'd be challenging.
Hey, Dream, this is Joey. Kelly has what he calls a black room. He has strict diets for women he's controlling. This sounds a lot like similarities between Christian Grey from, say, 50 Shades of Grey. How much do you think representations of men in popular culture and internalized misogyny have helped Kelly get away with what he's done for so many years?
You know, it's interesting that you bring up BDSM, which is what you just did, with 50 Shades of Grey, because I wanted, when I first, you know, came onto this project, and I was invited onto this project after two of the EPs had developed relationships with survivors and had already pitched the project to Lifetime. But even in my first conversations, I wanted to be with the other producers and with Bree Bryant from Lifetime. I said, you know, we have to be sex positive in this approach. Like, I want to, in fact, I said, I'm going to talk to, I know someone who does roping, who is, who does bondage and Japanese roping. I can't remember the name of that roping. She paid her way through graduate school. She got her PhD by roping Texas oil men, by tying them up, you know? That's what they're into, like Homeboy from Billions, right? So, like, to be conscious of that, like, to be like, am I looking at some people who are submissive, like, who are looking, who are entering consensual relationships where they would like to be dominated, you know? And so I talked, and so my friend in Texas who does bondage work connected me with four or five of her friends who also do BDSM work. And I said to them, hey guys, I described some of the scenarios, and they said, hell to the no. This is absolutely not. They said submissives have an enormous amount of power. They set the parameters in a BDSM relationship. And they say when it ends. And what I was describing to her, which was a recount of what was, you know, being told to our team and then to me personally, did not at all fit into a BDSM. So I believe, I say that to say that, you know, one of the things that R. Kelly is kind of advancing is he puts his, like, he's being, you know, accused, and I hate the word sex cult. I mean, I don't think that, and I know that Jim DeRogatis didn't come up with that. That was just BuzzFeed's way of being sticky with their headline. But what he is advancing is this kind of, hey, we're having a good time. We're adults. We may not have the kind of sex that you have, but it's all legal. That's what he's advancing when he parades, in the face of being accused of having a sex cult, R. Kelly parades two of his lovers who are 30 years younger than him. He's accused of sleeping with underage girls and having a sex cult, and his response to that is to put two girls who are just out of their teens in front of Gayle King as his girlfriend. That's a lot of hubris, first of all.
Yeah.
But what he means to do when he does that is to say, you guys are some prudes. We're having lots of grown-up fun. And, you know, so whatever, you know? And so I wanted to be aware of all that kind of thinking as I went into this. And I'm not interested in policing the kind of sex that adults have with each other consensually. Mm-hmm. I'm not interested in that at all because it doesn't just happen in Hollywood. I mean, R. Kelly's in the Midwest, you know? In fact, it happens in places where people are bored. You know, there's all kinds of stuff happening in all kinds of places, right? And I'm not interested in policing that. But these, you know, we were getting stories of abuse and abuse of very young girls and women that showed evidence that this man had a pattern of predation, that he was in a bibliophile. I always mispronounce that word, but it's not a pedophile. He's attracted to pubescent girls. And that he abuses them in other ways too, physically, which surprised me. I've known about the fact that he was a predator for almost two decades, but it wasn't until the women sat before me that I was very surprised to hear stories about being refused food, being refused movement, you know, all kinds of things. That surprised me, quite frankly.
I thought it was interesting when one of the people you interviewed said that if these victims were white women, he'd be in jail. And I was wondering if you think that's true, especially since so many of his fans, even other women of color, have rallied around Kelly and said these women are lying. Like, I go back and forth on whether I wonder about this, but I was wondering what you thought.
Well, I go back and forth also. I mean, I think two things. I think, on one hand, victims of sexual violence and gender violence aren't out here, like, receiving a lot of justice in our system, period.
Yeah.
It's one of the most underreported crimes, because it's very often mishandled. I mean, I'm from Detroit. I think that we have more than 10,000 unprocessed rape kits.
Wow.
You know, Andrea Ritchie did an amazing a book and accounting of how often women are, you know, re-traumatized and often abused when they go, say, to the police. you know, in Invisible No More is the name of Andrea Ritchie's book. So, I mean, and that's across, that's regardless of race, but of course, in, as in all kind of metrics, yeah, women of color end up being, like, over represented in those numbers when it comes to injustice. But what they're also speaking to, and I can't remember who said it right offhand. I mean, a couple of people said it in interviews. So I can't, yeah. Right now, I can't remember who said it in the film. But absolutely, you know, right now in this moment in this country, when we're talking about our painful history of white supremacy, you know, there is that history where, you know, we were chattel and it was not a crime to rape black women. And so there are ways that, you know, it is still in our lizard brain impossible to imagine that we can be violated, you know? And there are all kinds of evidence of, like, bias. And the most, like, straightforward, without going into some 500-year-old history, evidence of that is with the juror who we have on camera, who says, I just didn't believe these women. Now, he doesn't say because they were black. But what he does say is, I didn't like the way they talked. I didn't like the way they dressed. You know, all of these are things that speak to his bias. You know, maybe if they had, you know, it, and of course, all women have to face this when they go to the court. You have to come in dressed like a school teacher. Because if you have on these gold earrings, if you have like a hairstyle that he's not familiar with, if you don't speak the kind of English, this man was an immigrant, his English isn't terrific, but if you speak a kind of, like, a way that he associates with, say, love and hip-hop, you know what I mean? Like, all of these things are implicit in what he was saying. And we see that across the board. I'm not saying that these women are getting any more kind of support in the black community. I mean, they were disbelieved, as you said. We show fans outside of the R. Kelly concert, and they're defending him. And it makes no sense. Because there was the 2002. Yeah. These are people who are old enough to remember the 2002 video.
Yeah. That moment,
which no
actually,
one should
when
watch.
They, yeah. What, no, God. When they show, like, the people waiting in line for the concert, and they're just, like, the cycle of victim blaming that we constantly see with a highly publicized thing that really like freaked me out. And they were like, oh no, they're just doing it to, you know, they want to ruin him. And I was just like, stop.
Where have you seen that before? I mean, we saw Trump rallies where the next day women in their 50s had printed t-shirts that said, grab my,
Right.
Yeah.
You know? And they were showing up at the Trump rally saying, you know, saying what he said to to Bush, when I can't remember the Bush's name. He's like, he's been so disappeared from the public.
Yeah.
Billy Bush. What he said to
Billy
Bush,
right, yeah.
Yeah, ended up on t-shirts at Trump rallies the next day. So we're in a moment right now. We talked, and you would think that Me Too was a movement that was many years old. You know, that hashtag started about 2 years ago, but the pushback has lasted almost as long as the hashtag itself.
Yeah.
You know, and we could talk about that, but we don't have to. I mean, but the pushback is scary to me. You know.
Yeah. So one of the things that I felt fascinating also about the series is you don't ignore the sexual abuse that Robert suffers himself, but one of the most troubling aspects of this is when he uses his abuse history to connect with another young woman. How much do you think Kelly's behavior is a product of his abuse? And, I mean, there are plenty of people who suffer abuse but are good people. How do you think he became such a monster?
I don't like the word monster, but I understand it.
Yeah.
And his victims use that word, so I'll grant it to you. It's in our promo. It's in the commercial for Surviving R. Kelly. But it was important, obviously. I mean, not all victims of people who are victims of sexual abuse as children become abusers, but almost all abusers were abused, you know?
Mm.
But the degree, like you said, you point to this manipulation. I mean, one of the things that I heard again and again, and it was from women who'd met him from the time he began getting charged with misconduct and worse in 2002, which is around that time. Mm-hmm. Every woman talks about, these aren't women who knew each other. These are women who came into his life in 03, 06, 09, 2012, 2018. They all describe having to write these false confessions.
Yeah.
Where, and I tried to establish that in the film. We didn't have a lot of time to lay that out, but we do talk about it, where they would have to write these things. He would make them, you know. He would say, listen, you know, I have had people really exploit me and try to abuse my generosity, and I just need you to write this out for me. I need you to say that you lied about your age when we met, or that your parents are trying to extort me. And this would be second or third meeting with these women, that he would get this in writing. So that speaks to not only this level of awareness, you know, but also a strategy, a legal strategy that I bet he didn't come up with on his own. And so to imagine that there might have been some attorney who said, listen, Rob, if you're going to do this, if you're not like, dude, go get help, forget making records, this is going to, you can't, this is going to catch up with you. You can't escape this fate. Instead of saying, go get the help that you need, they gave him a strategy on how to get around being prosecuted. I'm like, you know, that to me, and of course I'm speculating. I have no idea that that's how it happened. He could have come up with it on his own. But that idea is like chilling to me.
Yeah.
You know, in, as you show, so many of the families allow R. Kelly into their daughters' lives because they think, hey, I'm here, I'm watching, you know, he's not, nothing's going to happen because I'm present, I'm involved, but it still happens. How do you think they missed that? How do you, were they blinded by celebrity? How do you think they let that go on?
I think they were blinded by patriarchy. I think that men believe that they have, that their presence is this superpower, you know?
Yeah.
We have a myth in this country. I mean, I'm old enough to remember Reagan when everything got blamed on single mothers, you know? Mm-hmm. That somehow it was the absence of a father in a household that was was responsible for
yeah.
everything that was wrong in society, right? But in both
yeah.
of these cases, you have present dads, and I had a dad. I mean, he was a control of the remote control. That was his job. You know, sometimes he was nice on the walk, and he was nice on the grill. He was great. I mean, but it wasn't some magic bullet to have a dad in the house, right? I still snuck out at 15. My parents didn't know where I was from 15 to 30. In fact, I started stealing my parents' car at 12, you know? So this idea that, first of all, teenagers are this super controllable group, I don't know. I thought we had movies about that since James Dean. I grew up on John Hughes films. I mean, Charlie Brown doesn't even have adults in it. Like, I don't know where we get this idea that, like, adults or the Rugrats, right? I don't know where we get this idea that, like, parents are, like in control of teenagers, A. So I think it's really unfair to blame the parents. B, these men, the two girls that are with him now come from, as you can see, two-parent households where, yes, the father spoke to R. Kelly, and they thought that that was going to be enough. And I'm sad that they had to learn the hard way, you know? That it's no match. Being a present father isn't a match for a predator.
Right.
You know, both of them, when I asked them the really hard question, I had to ask them because I, unlike a lot of people in the public and on social media, do not blame any of the sets of parents, including the single mom of Dominique, Michelle, who got her daughter back on camera. I don't blame any of those parents. I blame the predator, right? But I did have to ask them, hey, guys, you know, this tape, again, your daughter might have been six when this 2002 videotape, this rape tape, was out in the public. you know, they don't know about it, but you guys did. And if you didn't watch it, you saw the Dave Chappelle skit, you saw the Boondocks skit, you saw the South Park skit. It was a part of the zeitgeist, you know? We talked about it in the public. So I did have to ask that hard question. And each of them said that he was found not guilty. And I find that an unsatisfying answer, because even though he was found not guilty, we knew he wasn't innocent.
Yeah.
Wow.
In the final episode, by the way, we just have a few more questions for you. The final episode, one of R. Kelly's victims talks about him threatening her and her family's life. And I was wondering, do you think he's capable of killing, or do you think he's possibly, like, have women been silenced, like, in a way where, have they been killed, or we possibly, where their stories were never able to be told?
No, we don't have any evidence of murder at all. But I think that the recent indictments that in one of the women, Lisa Van Allen, talks about Daryl Mick, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name. I'm on vacation right now. I don't have notes in front of me. McDaniel, he was a part of his team. And she's the one who talks about feeling like her life was threatened. Well, the feds have indicted him, too. So they must have evidence of that kind of pattern of what Lisa Van Allen saying for our cameras being true, in a way that they were able to indict him. They must have had enough evidence to prove that he was involved in at least threatening people. I think that the threat of violence is a crime, if I'm not mistaken. I know that there are people in Chicago who, you know, R. Kelly was the only game in town for a long time. In terms of the entertainment world, and a lot of people, you know, we talk about them as his runners, as his assistants, but there are a lot of people who were getting paid off of him. You know, he's wasted and blown about $200 million, and some of that has been taking care of other people who, you know, returned that with silence. You know. Return that payment with silence and looking the other way, and sometimes probably doing even worse things, like threatening women.
So as you look at what's going on right now in with the, you know, bringing him to justice, what does it feel like to you personally to have your work of art a part of that conversation, a part of that process to bring him to justice?
Well, it's complicated, you know. I'm someone who, as you can probably tell from this interview, I think about a lot of things all the time and from different angles. You know, I wrote about it in Time magazine, like what justice might look like for R. Kelly. And I'm someone who doesn't believe in our criminal justice system. I don't think that it needs reform. I think that it needs to be torn down. You know, it's based on you know, white supremacy, quite frankly. And so I understand this kind of knee-jerk reaction that we have as black people to protect black men in particular who are accused of crimes, because there's a history in this country of false accusations, you know? At the same time, so there is a whole conversation happening in the communities I belong to around transformative justice and restorative justice. But those processes, you know, they require that someone come to the table admitting the harm that they've done. And like Brett Kavanaugh, you know, R. Kelly has refused that. Like Trump, R. Kelly's refused that. He's doubled down. You know, I think about how healing it would have been if R. Kelly would have taken that time with Gayle King to say, you know, I myself was abused as a child, and I may not know what a healthy sex life is. I don't know how many women I've harmed in the past 3 decades, and I'm going to go and get help. But instead, he turned himself into a victim. He yelled, he screamed, he acted like Brett Kavanaugh. I think about what it would have meant had Brett Kavanaugh said, I barely remember the 80s. Me and Squeegee and all these friggin' kids from my high school, I don't remember how much we drank. This was Animal, whatever his name was. We used to watch Animal House and get wasted. And what she just testified to does not sound unlike me and my friends. I've spent the past 40 years trying to become a better man, a better Christian. I could have written this for him. You know what I mean?
Yep.
It
yeah.
would have been so healing.
Yep.
Instead of getting red in the face and giving us a Matt Damon worthy satire piece, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know.
So, you know, since the R. Kelly, you know, situation has been so ongoing, we have Surviving R. Kelly, The Aftermath, a four-part follow-up series coming up. What can you tell us about that? Like, I know it's gonna have interviews with new survivors and psychologists. Can you tell us anything about that?
You know, I really can't. I'm not the showrunner on that.
Oh, okay.
Nope, I'm an EP.
Okay.
And so I weigh in with my thoughts, and I have lots of thoughts all the time. But this is not going to be my project in the way that
okay
was.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Dream. It's been great chatting with you. What a great conversation. Thank you for being on the podcast while you're on vacation. We really appreciate it.
Oh, no, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for having me. And I hope you guys enjoy the rest of your summer. I mean, in L.A., we get to have September, too, but I'm out here having a nice... I'm having an East Coast August summer, and it's great. Thank you.
Oh, nice.
Oh, awesome. Great. Yeah, we want to remind everyone to watch Surviving R. Kelly if they haven't already. It's on Lifetime. And also to subscribe to our podcast and give us a review. Thank you for listening to this special Awards Daily Water Cooler podcast, and have a pleasant tomorrow.